Yesterday, the Blue Jays, Marcus Stroman was a little bit banged up before the All-Star break came out. Had a nice game. Looked good. I'm sure everybody took a little bit of a deep breath and felt good about that. But as we move forward, go to the trade deadline, how many teams will be interested in him? And do we really know what the competition in the trade, what the trade market is? And what are the Mets going to do? And where does Stroman stand in all that?
Marcus Stroman's market, guys, is really interesting. Because I think part of it has to do with Marcus Stroman's reputation around the game. They know that he can be a hard-headed guy, and they know that he does things his way. And that's a really good thing for some teams, and other teams may shy away from that because when you have a particular type of chemistry that you've built up over the first, you know, few months of the season, that's something that you may not want to interrupt by bringing in people with strong personalities in trades. One name that makes a ton of sense in need and in fit is the Houston Astros. And I'm not saying that Marcus Stroman is going to be traded to the Houston Astros, but if there is a favorite right now in terms of teams that have deep enough farm system to give the Blue Jays what they're looking for, a need for a starting pitcher, and guys like Justin Verlander and Gerrit Cole, who are going to indoctrinate him right into the system and show him the wonders of what coming to Houston can do for a pitcher, I think it is the Astros. And I think the fit is too good for them not to be the favorite right now.
This seems like an obvious comment, Jeff, but I mean, you have dealt and spoken to people in every front office, agents, etc. The Blue Jays have a recent history in making moves with the Houston Astros, whether it was the Liriano-Teoscar Hernandez trade of a couple of years ago or the Roberto Osuna situation and how that played out approximately 1 year ago. To what extent do relationships between two front offices sway a potential acquiring team into the front seat versus, say, a team you don't deal with as much or if there's a little bit of friction between two general managers?
It is easier to get to a point where you're ready to consummate a deal when you're comfortable having dealt with that team in the past. That said, I think that front offices, leery's the wrong word. I think the right word is that they want to be careful that their level of comfort with another executive doesn't lead them down the path where they don't make the best deal. I think this time of year, they are looking to leverage every last ounce that they possibly can when they're selling of teams against one another. And that's a perfectly reasonable and frankly correct thing to do. So just because there is that past with the Astros and Blue Jays, I don't know if that makes a deal that much likelier. But let's put it this way. They clearly have a good working relationship with one another, and they find common ground. And that's the thing that can be difficult to do this time of year, especially when there are so few teams selling right now that the Blue Jays feel like they have hand in this situation.
Okay, so question for you that you'll answer, and then I want to piggyback off of that. What is your assessment right now, Jeff, of where the Blue Jays are at in this rebuild? When you look around the diamond at the big league level, you know Bo Bichette is going to join the fray here at some point sooner rather than later. What do you like about what you're seeing? What do you worry about what may be missing?
I love the bats. And I'm talking Vladdy Jr. And I'm talking Bo Bichette. And I did not think 2 months ago that this name was going to appear anywhere near the list. Lourdes Gurriel has turned into a hitter, and it's been really cool to see. Long-term, Kevin Biggio remains to be seen, but I like the fact that he's got a 350 on base in 40 games. That seems like it's real. And if that's real, he's going to be part of the solution. You know, where does Randall Grichuk fit into all this? I don't know if he ends up in a corner. I don't know if he stays in center. I'm curious to see if Anthony Alford ultimately turns into a guy You notice, though, the one thing that I haven't mentioned is pitching. And I think the Trent Thornton trade was a good one. I like the stuff. I like the curveball. I wonder, a guy like Sam Gavilio, like, I really do wonder if he's somebody you can flip at the deadline now and get a lot for, because, you know, homers aside, he's been really good this year. But there's just not a lot of long-term pitching help there. You know, Nate Pearson has been one of the standout prospects in all of baseball this year, and I think it's a pretty fair thing to say that you envision him as top of the rotation guy, but they need a lot, and I mean a lot more pitching. And it reminds me in a way of how the Chicago Cubs approach this. The difference, guys, is that the Chicago Cubs were willing to go out and spend money on pitching. Are Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins going to be willing to pursue pitching on the free agent market, which can be extraordinarily expensive in the same kind of way, because they're going to need to.
With Jeff Passan of ESPN. And so I asked you a question where I assumed you'd identify the strengths and the weaknesses as you did, which allows me to follow up as planned. It's a perfect interviewing trait. Maybe I should try it more often. So this has been my, I don't know if it's a hot take, Jeff. You can say that it is if it is, and say that I'm onto something if I'm onto something. I view what we believe to be the impending trades of Marcus Stroman and Ken Giles as a litmus test for this front office. That if you hit on the return for these two players in particular, you can advance the rebuild. If you miss, you can stunt it or set it back. So working off of that, agree or disagree, number one. And number two, is this Giles elbow stuff a bit of a mitigating factor at this point, considering that he got a massage a few days ago and his elbow hurts?
Disagree and yes, and I'll go point by point. I think far more important than the returns for two trades that, while in a market that is in favor of sellers, is still a market that does not return quite what it used to. I think judging the trajectory of the rebuild based on that is probably not the right thing. I think, to me, the litmus test on this rebuild is how consistently the organization is turning out major league players. Now, this has been a really good year for that. You're going to have Vlad. You're going to have Biggio. You're going to have Bo Bichette. Hopefully, presumably, like, I'd like to think they're not going to service time him. They may still. But you're going to have graduations of impact type players. And that, to me, is what you're looking for in a rebuild. The likelihood, guys, that they get a foundational player in a trade for either Marcus Stroman or Ken Giles is small to nil. And that says that's no insult of the Blue Jays front office. That's just the reality of the trade market at the deadline in 2019. Marcus Stroman's not a good enough pitcher to get a top 15 or 20 prospect in return. We're not looking at that with him. And Ken Giles is a closer with a history of some volatility and questions about how he would react in the playoffs. And you combine that with the elbow, and it's, you know, what the Blue Jays are going to be offered until Ken Giles comes back and shows that he's healthy and he's ready to pitch, night and day with what they would have otherwise.
Do you see a scenario where there might be a team that might jump out of the norm right here and maybe, you know, shoot for the moon, kind of like we did in 2015? And one team that kind of comes to mind with me is San Diego. They seem to be very interesting. They seem to have tons of prospects in the minor leagues that people are very interested in. And is that a team that might be able to step up and actually might overpay for some of these guys?
You know, I don't see San Diego. San Diego's going to do what, or going to, is trying to do what Tampa Bay did last year. And the Rays, honestly, were in a better position to do this because they were, frankly, a better team than the Padres are right now. But what the Rays did is they traded Chris Archer, you know, a guy who presently, theoretically, was helping them, and went out and got Austin Meadows and Tyler Glasnow and Shane Boz, who's turned into a really good prospect, and the first two have turned into really good players. So they were sacrificing the now a little bit for the immediate future. They did the same thing with Tommy Pham. They bought low on him, and he's been honestly spectacular. The fact that there's only a season and a half of control for Marcus Stroman and Ken Giles makes me wonder whether they're the right fit for the Padres. I think the Padres, and, you know, they're dangling Franmil Reyes and Hunter Renfroe. These are guys who are probably the best bats on the market right now. Like, it is bad how little hitting there is available at this point. Because they have power hitting outfielders available, there, you know, there's going to be some interest there, but I just don't see the Padres as being the go for it team. Part of me wonders, are we going to see Alex Anthopoulos do his thing again and have the Braves be that team that is trying to fend off a Nationals team that's been playing really well lately?
With Jeff Passan of ESPN at Sportsnet Today, Scott MacArthur, Tim Leeper, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Changing directions here just a little bit. During the All-Star game, the players talked a lot about the union, and the union players talked about the rules, the lack of, you know, options now for free agents and the dwindling contracts for guys under 30 years or over 30 years old. Can you see a scenario where they may try to open up negotiations or even strike during the course of the next CBA or till the CBA expires?
You know, they can't strike until the next CBA is up because that would be deemed an illegal strike and would be thrown out in court instantaneously. What they can do is they can threaten to strike once it's up in December of 2021. And I, you know, as the days go by, I worry we're getting closer and closer to that scenario. This midterm bargaining that they were supposed to be engaging in has been absolutely fruitless at this point. And the big question for me when all of this is going on is the union clearly wants concessions. And that's all well and good. I don't blame them. It was not a collective bargaining agreement negotiated in 2016 that particularly behooved them. But when you're looking for something to be conceded, and when you're looking for it in the fashion that the union is, an unprecedented midterm negotiation, you got to have something to give back. And I don't know what the union has to give back at this point. And look, for the first time since I've been covering baseball, and I started in 2004, the words salary cap have come up, and they've come up increasingly frequently. I'm not saying there's going to be a salary cap. There is absolutely going to be conversations about a salary cap. And where that goes, I'm fascinated to see, because there are people inside of baseball right now on the player side who believe a cap system would be preferable to what they have right now.
Trying to create, yeah, the owners trying to create the landscape where the cap becomes preferable, because the thing, and Jeff, you know this, hockey players are in a cap system, but they're fighting the same sort of issues where you got guys coming out of their entry-level deals as 21, 22-year-olds and trying to sign long-term deals because they know at 29 or 30, with all the sports science, the analytics, the data saying, hey, at 29, yep, 30, suddenly you're old. Well, yep. Major League, yep, Baseball, I mean, it's totally different. For every Mike Trout and Juan Soto and Bryce Harper who break in at 19 or 20, or Vladimir Guerrero Jr., you got thousands of guys who get in at 23, 24 after a routine minor league developmental trajectory. They don't hit free agency till 30, so their salaries are controlled for the first 3 years. They try to do what they can in arbitration if they haven't signed a long-term deal. And then at 30 years old, they know, because they're looking ahead now and seeing it, that they're not going to get paid. So they're getting squeezed on the young end, squeezed on the old end. Is the cap and whatever the fallout from that in terms of concessions by either side, is the cap the way to begin to fix it?
It can be, but there are so many other problems that come with the cap. And that's the thing. Like, the cap is not a panacea. The cap can be presented as a panacea, but it's not in and of itself. You need the right levers in place in order to make a cap work. And look, it's not like the cap precludes there from being labor discord. Like, there has been that in the NFL and in the NBA, and there still is in the NHL right now. So if the Major League Baseball Players Association, and I know at the highest levels they do not believe this, but they are ultimately subject to the whims and to the decisions of their constituents. The people at the top of the MLBPA do not want a cap. They're going to have to listen, though, because unless they can make something out of thin air that they have to offer, it's going to be either a really, really difficult negotiation trying to find that, or they're just going to end up with a work stoppage. And I honestly don't think anybody in his or her right mind inside of the game right now believes that is the optimal path to take.
How does the service time situation, in your opinion, we understand that there's a negotiation here and we're a couple years up, but how does this service time situation resolve itself? Do you see that moving in any particular direction once we get to whatever point it is that we're going to end up at?
I laugh, Scott, not at you nor at your question, but at the fact that you threw out something that is so incredibly difficult to answer, and that I've been trying to come up with the right solution here for, you know, the last 10 years in stories, and I just never feel like I get to the proper place where it would be a mutually beneficial system. My argument from the start has been, and my argument will continue to be, that the 750 best baseball players in the world, regardless of how young they are, should be in the major leagues at any given time, and that you need to have a system that incentivizes teams to do that, that does not penalize teams for coming up at a particular age. Now, is the solution age-based free agency? You can argue that that's the case. The problem with that is that the average Latin American player is signing at 16, maybe 17 years old, while the average American, Canadian, Puerto Rican player is signing at earliest, late, on the cusp of him turning 18. In a lot of cases, him being about the middle of his 18th birthday, and in most cases, him being around 20, 21. And so all of a sudden, if you have American players who are hitting free agency earlier than Latin players, what does that say about how you're valuing Latin players and the equitability in the system? Like, that's why there's no easy solution, because while it should be the case that everybody hits free agency at 26 to 27 years old to maximize their value, there's just no quick and clean way to do this. Everything and every scenario that you put out there gets muddy and dirty. And that's part of the conundrum that these sides are facing, and why, you know, a year and a half ago now, I wrote a story that said baseball's economic system is broken. And in a lot of ways, it is. It is a broken system because of misplaced incentives, because of misplaced priorities. And that goes for both sides. I mean, I look at the union right now, and I know the union exists to protect all players, and particularly exists to protect older players. But any rational person is going to look at a player's age and just at the aging curve in general, guys, and say, yeah, the numbers kind of bear this out, and that there are going to be outliers. And we can acknowledge that there are going to be outliers, but we can't sit here and pull our hair out at the idea that once someone gets past age 30, he's going to be on the decline. It's just plain and simple fact.
Right. And what do you do? Another subset, Jeff, is what do you do with the Josh Donaldsons of the world who wake up one day at age 27 and become one of the best players in the game after muddling along in a minor league career for the better part of a decade? Like, how do you account for them? Does he hit 30 home runs for the Oakland A's and then all of a sudden hits free agency because he happens to be 28? I mean, that's another subsection of all this.
It is. And the biggest conundrum is with the Players Association, because the Players Association is fighting for all of these disparate subsets in its constituency. It's incredible. You have the guys like Josh Donaldson who end up, you know, having to sign 1-year deals. And you have the guys like Juan Soto or Ronald Acuna, who, you know, Juan Soto is up at 19. Ronald Acuna is up at 19. Acuna ends up getting paid, but well under market for the way that he's projected to perform, while Soto is probably going to be out there and going to get paid more, yes, but is he going to get value commensurate with his performance? That's really difficult to say. Then you have the players who are in their 30s and who are pissed because they feel like they've been tossed to the trash heap. And I understand that. When your market has been depressed, and it is artificially depressed, not, Scott, just for those first 3 years. It's for the first 3 years and for 3 years after that. And, oh, for a year after that, too, because they serve as time manipulated. Mm-hmm. You have 7 years. And I understand arbitration pays, but arbitration pays, you know, 60% maybe over the course of the 3 years of what your free market value would be at those ages. When you have that, and then you're telling me if I'm a 30-year-old free agent, you're not going to pay me on the back end either? We got to pay me on one of those sides. And that's why it was so interesting to hear Tony Clark say this is not a distribution issue. Said that at the All-Star game. Major League Baseball looks at this like a distribution issue. Like, okay, well, we have a fixed pool of money, and that fixed pool is either going to go to younger players or older players. Pick your poison. And the union said, no. This is not a distribution issue. We feel like the younger players should get paid and the older players should get paid, which is a perfectly reasonable perspective to try and make a deal from and negotiate from. But what you're doing there is you are implicitly arguing that the split of revenues between the sport and the players right now is not where it should be. And boys, the second you bring up revenue split, what do you start talking? Sounds like a cap system.